This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Sub-Saharan Africa has the most serious HIV and AIDS epidemic in the world. In 2012, roughly 25 million people were living with HIV, and that accounts for nearly 70% of the global total. The battle is ongoing as researchers, educators, and doctors continue to work to stop AIDS once and for all. Sequoia Helping Hands is a local nonprofit doing its part by attacking the disease at the grassroots level with AIDS awareness campaigns and by providing health care, shelter, and food so that children can grow into healthy adults. The group also assists children by providing education so that they can become self-sufficient after childhood. The organization was founded by Juni Asio, a Triangle software engineer who's originally from a village in Kenya, and she joins us today. Juni, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you, Frank, for giving me the privilege of being here today. Yes, I'm originally from Kenya. I was born in Nairobi, but my ancestral village is in a place called Wikondiek. Wikondiek is on the shores of Lake Victoria. It's actually about maybe 10 to 20 miles away from the lake, and it's a very rural area. It's not what many people think when they go to Africa, they see all these animals. No, there are no wild animals. There's just a few huts and homesteads and people. And there's no electricity, no running water, no paved roads, but that is where my home is.
A number of ethnic groups or tribes, we might say, in Kenya. You were a member of the Luo, right?
Yes, I am a member of the Luo tribe. Luo means to follow, which means we originated from the Upper Nile and followed it all the way down to the source of the Nile, which is Lake Victoria. And by the way, Lake Victoria is the second largest freshwater lake in the world. So the Luos have settled all around the lake. You will find Luos in Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, and in southern Sudan. Now, the Luos of Kenya, our population is about 4 to 5 million. And it's very interesting that even though we are from the lake, the largest second largest freshwater lake, I mentioned that we do not have running water. And many of the diseases that we faced are waterborne diseases, yet we have fresh water. I think that's a bit ironic.
Well, tell me, what was it like growing up in that village and with your family and with your neighbors? What was everyday life like?
I actually spent the academic year in Nairobi and the holidays we spent in the villages. In Kenya, you go to school for 3 months, then you have 1 month off. 3 months, 1 month off. That's because we really don't have to deal with winter and summer and all of that. And it was like living in two worlds. When I was in school in Nairobi, I went to Kenya High School. It was a very British school. I mean, think Harry Potter. We had high tea. We lived in dormitories. We had Yorkshire pudding. And then when I went up country, there's no electricity. We are eating local food, you know, traditional foods. You're walking everywhere. So it was living in two worlds. And I just took that as normal. I just assumed the world was made up of more than one world.
How normal was your circumstance going away to a boarding school in Nairobi with Yorkshire pudding and all of and high tea? Were you privileged even within your group, or was that pretty common for people who lived in your community?
I think we were very privileged. I think we were not wealthy, and we're still not wealthy, but we were privileged. My mother worked for the United Nations eventually, but she started off. My mother was very many firsts. For example, she was the first president of the Maendeleo ya Wanawake. That is an organization of women. She was also the first assistant commissioner of prisons. She was the first UN Goodwill Ambassador for the Development Fund for Women. She was the first African on the UN Subcommission on the Elimination of Discrimination and Protection of Minorities. So she was many firsts, and that enabled us to get a lot of privileges. My father also worked very closely with the Kennedy Airlift in bringing people to the United States. He actually went to college here. So we really did have a lot more. And also, where we lived in a place in Kenya called Ziwani, and among our neighbors was Nyerere, who ended up to be the president of Tanzania. There was Obote, who ended up being the president of Uganda. It was the African reserve at that time. So I think that helped a lot in our living a very privileged life.
And you talked about the number of international organizations and human rights organizations that your mother worked for and led. But also, because she was so closely connected with these leaders, she became confidants within local politics as well and national politics in Africa. Am I right? Did she serve as an advisor to some of those?
Yes, she actually ended up running for office and being elected in parliament. When my mother was raised, my grandfather, which is my mother's father, was a Kir. A Kir among the Luos is a social and cultural custodian. Luos are very big on education and on culture. And my mother was not brought up traditionally. She hung out with her father, my grandfather. She was herding cows and goats, and she was brought up more as a boy than as a girl. But when he became Kir, she would attend these meetings where decisions were being made. And she realized that to do anything for women, she needed a place at that table. So she decided to run for office. And when she decided to run for office, her mother was quite upset because Luos were not having the easiest time in Kenya at that time. Luos have traditionally always been in the opposition. And when she decided to run, actually, my grandmother basically had a funeral for her with the understanding that she was probably going to be killed.
So it was unusual for women and Lua to be this active.
It was unusual for women. Luos have always allowed women to grow. In fact, my mother is the first and only woman elder among the Luos. And that happened a few years ago, and that's a wonderful thing. It basically means she has reached the age of men, as they call it. In other words, she's officially a guy now.
She also was very active in philanthropic concerns and charitable projects as well, and got you involved, whether you wanted to or not, right?
Yes, and the African culture, the Luo culture, is we all help each other. So when she was doing all of this, helping others, and we were also being helped. For example, my mother traveled a lot. My father was gone for a long time. We never really noticed that we were alone because we had so many relatives and uncles and aunts. And so as she was traveling all over, they all took care of us. And I just kind of took it for granted that people helped each other. And it was when I went back to work for AMREF that I realized that maybe that's not the normal. Maybe that's not the norm.
Today we are meeting Juni Aseo on the state of things. She's living in the Triangle in North Carolina right now, but she is from Kenya and has figured out a way to help out people and go back frequently to help out with some of the needs in that country. She also, when she was associated with the prison, she also got a project going there that you were involved in, right?
Yes. Actually, when my mother was working at the prisons, at that time she was working at the women's prison. And the women, the types of crimes they committed were mostly crimes of need. They were not crimes of greed. For example, they would be arrested for hawking, you know, things like that. And then they'd be put in prisons, and then there was nowhere to take their children. So she ended up bringing their children also in the prisons. And she started having the women make arts and crafts, which she would take with her to the UN to sell. One of the things that she made, which I loved and one day I hope to see again, was they would buy these little 8-inch dolls and dress them in traditional African clothes. And she would bring them and sell them. And the money would go back to the women. And I would love to have an opportunity to do that.
So as you saw all of this happening around you, what is normal for you is somewhat unusual for the culture at large because of all the firsts that your mother made. Clearly, it wasn't common. What were your aspirations for yourself? Did you see yourself as sort of an advocate and an activist in this way? Or what were you thinking as a young girl growing up?
No, I did not see myself. I was not going to do what my mother did. I was not going to do what my father did. I was going to be different. And I did not even, you know, we grow up with our parents and we really don't, we diminish what they do. We don't think of it as if they're doing anything special. But when I went to AMREF, and AMREF is the African Medical Research Foundation, I went there after I returned to Kenya, after I had finished college. And AMREF also runs the Flying Doctor Service. And I went there and I was their computer services manager. So therefore, I was in charge of everything electronic, you know, which was challenging. But the types of things that AMREF did, I'll give you an example. There was one day where there was a young boy who had been shot by an arrow. The arrow had gone into his eye and was lodged into his brain. And what the Flying Doctor Service would do is they would go and bring these people to Nairobi. And if there were doctors around, they would ask them to come and volunteer, to come and do whatever surgery needed to be done. And this young boy, they removed this arrow and he was absolutely fine. And when he was interviewed, he was asked, what are you going to do next? He says, I'm going right back there and this time I'm going to get the people who got me with this arrow. And I also had the privilege of mapping the airstrips in Kenya because there were small planes that the doctors fly in. And one of the planes, I remember, it landed somewhere and they hadn't been told that it had been raining, so the plane flipped over. It was at AMREF that I realized that, my goodness, there are actually organizations that actually help people and that they would actually pay me to help people. Yes, the UN was helping people, but the UN was something that took away my mother, really. It wasn't necessarily something that I saw as helping people. That was my perspective. Now, the UN does wonderful things, so that was just a child's perspective.
How old were you at AMREF when you sort of had this observation?
Let's see. I had finished college, so maybe I was 30. I'm not sure. I was probably about 30. But it did open my eyes. That was when I started becoming aware of more.
Well, we'll talk about how that idea evolved and became Sequoia Helping Hands as we continue our conversation with Junie Aseo today on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, we're meeting local humanitarian and software engineer Junie Aseo. She's the founder of Sequoia Helping Hands, a local nonprofit aimed at improving living conditions in her native Kenya. So we talked about growing up in Africa. What brought you to the United States?
I came to the United States to go to college. My sister attended Antioch College, and my mother had been coming to the U.S. many times. My father attended college here, so it was natural I was going to come to college in the United States.
And what did you study?
I studied computer science, and I also studied industrial engineering.
All right. So at that point, what did you think you were going to do with all that? What were your dreams for yourself?
I was just going to work and make money and live long and be happy. However, one day during a trip to Kenya, I went on a vacation and I was walking in the village because, you know, I was used to going to Kenya and going to the village during the holidays. And I was walking and I met this young lady called Nyatanga, and she was really frustrated. She looked really, really frustrated. So I started talking to her because I love people. I talk to just about anybody I meet. And I said, what was the problem? And she said, oh, she's not well and she has these children and she doesn't know what she's going to do with them. It turned out she was HIV positive. She had AIDS. And I decided, one of the things I did was I took a picture of her because I thought, okay, I'll take a picture of her because I think she's nice. And later on, after she died, because she did die, I gave this picture to her children. And I realized that many of the children did not have pictures of their parents who had passed. And they very quickly forget what their parents looked like. So one of the things we did do with Sequoia was to go and take pictures of many adults so that the kids would have pictures should anything happen.
But again, this is your first moment of realization that there's plenty to do back at home in Kenya. Were you planning to stay and work in the United States when you left or abroad?
I was, but then I was actually figuring out, should I stay, should I go, should I stay, should I go? And I was living in North Raleigh at that time. And then there was a tornado that destroyed my house. And then I said, okay, that decision is made for me. The good news is I didn't have to worry about buying anything because I had nothing. I didn't have to worry about shipping anything because I had nothing. And I decided to go back to a place where there were no tornadoes, no hurricanes, no violent storms, and I was on the next plane to Kenya.
And what were you planning to do there?
I initially went to work at the Nairobi University. I was there for about 6 months. Then I got a job at AMREF, and AMREF paid well. And AMREF exposed me more to helping others from beyond my family. So AMREF was also sending me to different countries around East Africa to see what was happening. So that exposed me more and more.
You told the story, of course, AMREF, as you said before, African Medical and Research Foundation, and that was when you realized there were people who could do some good. They were helping. And also, you talked about Nyatanga's story. How aware of you were you of the AIDS epidemic before all of this, and to what extent did being part of that foundation make you more aware?
Yeah, excellent, because AMREF did make me more aware, because what happened was AMREF decided that because I'm the computer manager, because I knew how to use computers, when they got money from donors for people living with AIDS, I would be responsible for dishing out this money, monitoring it, and reporting on it. And so we would have meetings once every 2 weeks or so with the people who were living with AIDS, and we would give them money and we would say, what did you use the money for? Did you use it appropriately? And then we would give them more. It was really quite surreal because some days, one day you're in a meeting with somebody, next time the person isn't there and nobody asks because you know what? The person had probably died. And that was my first time coming up close with AIDS. And I remember being very nervous the first time I met somebody with AIDS because I thought, my goodness, can I shake their hand or not? Then I said, yeah, I'll just shake their hand and get it over with and move on. And because death was still new in Kenya then, like in America, generally children are not exposed to death. Death is something that happens to old people. That was true still in Kenya at that time, although now the young people were dying. We were spending a lot of money on funerals because a funeral was a big thing. And that was when I started becoming aware that why are we spending all this money on funerals and what is happening to the children? What was happening to the children? They were just kind of left there. And I saw this repeat itself time and time and time and time again until I actually had to do something about it. And Nyatanga's case is the one that actually distilled it and made me have to act.
And you did stay in touch a little bit with her daughter, right?
Yes. What happened in Nyatanga's case is after she died, my mother called me and said, oh, Nyatanga's dead. So, you know, we need money to bury her. Of course, her husband had died long ago. And then that's when I said, this is the last time I am sending money for a funeral. I am done with funerals. I'm dealing only with the children. And Nyatanga had three children. There was Jabuya, there was Ben Victor, and there was Maureen. Maureen was about 13 years old, 12, 13. And Nyatanga had mentioned that they needed a house. So we had built a house for her through Sequoia. Okay, so it was basically a mud hut with a metal roof, but it was a very good house. We had built her a house, and we thought, gee, we've done our good thing. We've built a house. The children have a home. Nyatanga's dead. We've buried her. I'll continue with my life. Unfortunately, we forgot Maureen. And children, girl children, are very endangered in Africa. Somebody came, a man came and told Maureen that if you come with me as my maid, I will send money to take care of your brothers. Because we're very social, of course she went. Well, in reality, she ended up not just being his maid, she ended up being his wife because he needed somebody to fetch water, take care of kids, clean the house, fetch firewood, all of that. So we lost Maureen, and that really upset me because I realized that in all of this wonderful work, we were patting ourselves on the back, we had forgotten the girl. So we decided to build a girl's dormitory. Again, I went to my friends and said, we got to do this. And we built a girl's dormitory.
It also suggests that you, as a computer expert, doing the research, pulling together the data, filing the reports that AMREF needed to demonstrate it was being responsible with its money, you could have been dealing simply with administrators, people who were administering the money. It does suggest that you were getting down to the grassroots level and
Absolutely. Going
kind of, person by person and house by house.
Absolutely. And that's the way AMREF actually worked. I think AMREF did not really have a separation. Everybody did the work. That was then. I sincerely hope the same is true now. But we were all involved in this effort.
And again, you point to some of the issues that we don't necessarily think about. If there's an epidemic or a drought or kind of a crisis, we know about that. But because people are living in such precarious situations, people who are abandoned, orphans, often end up in these situations, particularly women end up in situations like the one you described. And even Nyatanga's death suggests some of the fact is she wasn't getting the medicine that she needed owing to some of the corruption that was
going on. Yes, we had struggled really hard to get her some medicine, and it was a big struggle. My mother had pulled political clout, did whatever she could to get her medicine. And then, unfortunately, my mother had to come to the U.S., so Nyatanga had to go and get her medicine herself, and she would go, and instead of them giving her appropriate medicine, they would give her aspirin, and the officials would use their own medicine for their own relatives. You can't blame them, but that didn't solve our problem, and Nyatanga still died. Now, of course, there's medicine available.
So talk about how Sequoia Helping Hands came about. You talked about your friends, made a couple of references to what you've done. How did it actually come together, the organization?
I was working at EMC, and Sequoia is an organization that was formed by
EMC
people.
Here in North Carolina.
EMC in North Carolina. Sequoia is truly a North Carolina organization. I would tell the engineers, my engineering friends, about what was happening, and they kept saying, well, so let's do something. So one of them ran a half marathon, a friend of mine from Buffalo, ran a half marathon, collected money and said, okay, now we have some money, let's do something with it. But I want to be able to, I want to have a receipt. I want this to be a formal organization. So we registered Sequoia and we went to the village and said, okay, we need to build a house for Nyatanga and her children. Should we do this? And the community said, oh yeah, but not just her. We so-and-so also needs houses. So we ended up building actually 38 houses. Their average cost was about $400. And I want to state that I would not expect to pay that little now. The community got involved. The people who were receiving the homes helped. And basically these were mud huts. We used cow dung and anthill and built the house. And we added metal roofs so that they could collect drinking water. And after they had finished the house is when we would give them the water tanks. So it was really a community effort.
Who was building the houses? How so? What was the relationship between the triangle and the village itself?
Oh, my friends from here went to Kenya, bought the wood, walked all over, dragged it to wherever it needed to be and built the house. And you know, spoke to the people and just did what needed to be done.
And then what was the community's involvement? What were they doing?
They, you know, you require a lot of water when building. Mm. So you have to bring the water, collect the cow dung, you know, decide where exactly the house is going to be built because there's lots of traditional rules and regulations and also even just deciding exactly who truly was in need. It wasn't somebody coming to us and saying, I need a house. No, it was the community coming to us and say, so-and-so needs a house.
Well, that's interesting because it brings me to my next question. Once you're there, you can see the need. You could pretty quickly be overwhelmed and say, well, we can't build a house for everybody who needs one, even in this small region. I mean, did you come to that conclusion? What happened to you when you saw how vast the need might be?
We decided to just focus on one thing at a time. Now, fortunately, I have a sister in Germany. She is a doctor there. And so she also started a Sequoia Germany to kind of help us out. And the Germans have really been great. So, for example, when we built the dormitory, and this was mainly to protect the girls, we built the dormitory and were patting ourselves on the back. Dormitory is done. The Germans came and put in beds and put in mosquito nets and put in paint and all the other good stuff. So we have complimented each other. Yes, it is a very big job. It really is. But if everybody just takes care of their own little corner, then suddenly it's not such a big job. And our goal is not to change the world. Our goal is just to help those around us. And I'm hoping that they will also help those around them and so on and so on and so on. And I believe that's the way we'll be able to change the world.
Well, the vetting is the other problem, of course. People coming to you and then, as you say, how do we decide who really needs it and who doesn't? And the only reason you'd make that choice is because the resources are limited. So allowing the community to come and sort of make that, be that filter and be that vetting group it sounds like a pretty good way to go. Is it challenging for them? I mean, how do they decide who to say no to? They have to say no to somebody, don't they?
You know, the community, they know each other. They know who's truly in need. They know who isn't. So we worked with the schools, the headmaster of the primary school, the headmaster of the secondary school, the kindergarten teacher. We did start a nursery school. The church is very active. The chief, the local chief. I have to tell you a funny story about chiefs that my mother told me. She said long ago when the British first came to Kenya, they needed chiefs. And they're the traditional chiefs, but then there was also the paramount chiefs. And they didn't know how to select a chief. So what they did was they brought trousers, and in those days we used to run around, you know, wearing next to nothing. So they lined up the pants on the road and lined up the pants on the ground and lined up the men and blew a whistle, and the men had to run and try and put on the pants. And some would put two legs in one and some would have them backwards. But whoever had the pants on right, that was the chief. That is not the way we want to do things. We want to actually talk to the people and use what they have to select who's in need.
Yeah, and the fact that, and of course they needed a British, someone who would serve the interest of the British and not necessarily the community, which is the legacy of colonialism now. So the idea that you are from a village and they know you and you know them, I would think makes that whole process a lot easier.
It does, and they know I'm not going anywhere. You know, if I mess them up, they still see me. I'm not going anywhere. If I take anything that's theirs, they know. You know, they are my family. They are my people. They are me. You cannot steal from yourself. you cannot lie to yourself. You can, but at some point you just have to stop lying to yourself.
Well, this leads to some of the criticisms of NGOs and nonprofits these days, that they've become so large, that they're from other places. They don't take into account enough the resources and the talent and the treasure that's available in those places. And they're always looking for the chief who can put his pants on rather than the one who actually knows what the community needs. Do you find this? Do you come into contact with other? Certainly you did growing up. Your mother worked for a larger organization, the UN, for goodness sake. Is that a problem?
Yes, because when we first came up with Nyatanga's case, I thought, gee, this is a wonderful time. This is when I need to contact the big NGOs. They will come and they will help because this is what they do. They help. And then I very quickly realized that, nah, I'm going to have to write a proposal. I need a PhD. And then once they give me the money, I'm going to need to hire an army just to do the reporting. Mm. So that wasn't going to happen at all. And yet, Nyatanga's case is one, but there are many cases popping up all the time. The other day, my sister, who lived in America but has gone back to Kenya now, just the other day, she took a walk in the village. These walks in the village, they're actually quite interesting. And she heard somebody saying, help me, help me. She looked, and there was a woman giving birth on the side of the road. So my sister quickly calls the nurse and says, what do I do? The nurse is somewhere else. The nurse says, well, deliver the baby. So she delivers the baby, and then she says, now what do I do? I don't have anything to cut the cord. The nurse says, I don't care what you do. The rain is coming. That baby should not get wet. Figure it out. So my sister's carrying this woman with the baby, with the cord still attached, running to the closest hut. And the woman is saying, I told that man not to go to that soccer game. It was actually quite funny. The baby was born. The baby was named Centennial because we reached our 100th anniversary in that village also. Centennial Atieno also after my sister. And then, of course, the Germans, being good Germans, they decided they're going to provide equipment for maternity. So they provided the buckets and the baby, you know, scales and all the other good stuff.
Today, I am meeting Juni Asio on The State of Things. She's a local software engineer, but the founder of Sequoia Helping Hands, where she helps people back in her native Kenya, lives in the Triangle in North Carolina. But I guess that gets to the radical yes. The first thing you do is say yes, and then figure out sometimes how you're gonna actually handle the problem, right? Have you found yourself in that situation?
Oh, yes. Unfortunately, I'm not a planner. I just decide I'm going to do, and then I actually go back and I find the solution afterwards. But my friends have been amazing. You know, engineers like to solve problems, and I tell you, they sit there and they figure it out. And it may not be the most elegant or the most beautiful solution, but we have succeeded where others have not.
We've come up with some beautiful and ingenious solutions, including one volunteer who saw or found out about an empty classroom and decided kids really can't work that way. Tell us that story.
Yes. What happened was this. We had, for many years, the children had, again, this tied all to Ben Victor's story and Nyatanga. The children were sitting on the ground and they did not have uniforms. So we asked the headmaster, like, why don't the children have uniforms? He says, oh, the uniforms get old very quickly because the children have to sit on the ground because we don't have desks. So again, one of our engineering friends went and redesigned the desks completely because even though they were buying desks and building desks, the desks were breaking almost immediately. They were not lasting. So he redesigned the desks completely. We built desks, and for the first time in 100 years, every child in Bikondiek was sitting at a desk. And those desks were built over 10 years ago, and they're still going strong.
How important is it to develop solutions that use local resources and then allow local community members to become engaged in the business of, say, desk making or house building so that it can become a sustainable business rather than this kind of pipeline from somewhere else?
You know, it was extremely important. In fact, when he built these desks, he used two local primary school children to help with the building of these desks. So they know how to repair them if necessary. They know, and for example, the wood that was used, he went and did a research on the wood and used woods that's the exact correct width. In other words, did not design like a piece of wood that was 10 inches when the trees there are 5 inches.
Uh-huh.
You know, so everything was designed, a very elegant solution. Engineers have elegant solutions. Those desks are beautiful.
Today on The State of Things, we're talking with Juni Asio. She's a software engineer in the Triangle. She also founded the nonprofit Sequoia Helping Hands. And we will continue our conversation on The State of Things in just a moment. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, meeting humanitarian and software engineer Junie Asio. She founded the nonprofit Sequoia Helping Hands. It addresses the consequences of AIDS conditions in Kenya. Her organization has built homes. It provides food and brought doctors and medical care to the region where she was born. She now lives in the Triangle here in North Carolina. When we talked about the sense that this could start feeling overwhelming, how do you balance your time and how much time do you spend on Sequoia? And do you ever feel yourself kind of torn apart, pulled too far in one direction or another?
I really am torn apart, and I do work very hard on Sequoia. I adopted two children, and they are going to be taking over Sequoia from me, so I think that's wonderful. I guess what tears me apart, I understand that Sequoia is not about me. It's about the children in need. For example, I'll bring you, there's another child, Sharon, who I've been with since she was a baby. Sharon is now 13. She was born HIV positive. And by the way, these are the things that keep me going. At, you know, that midnight, when I'm burning that midnight oil, it's okay. I think of Sharon. So she was born HIV positive, and she has three other younger siblings, and she is the adult, okay? So they've grown up, but she takes very good care of them. And we put Sharon in boarding school, even though technically one would argue, why would we do that? She's HIV positive. She has three other children to take care of. And we put her in boarding school when she was about 9. And we said, you know what? Statistics are not looking too good for this child, so let her at least enjoy this. We'll figure out what to do with the younger children. And so I spoke to a boarding school in Kenya. They were wonderful. The headmistress said, well, this will just be our little secret. And that's what has happened. But then, so the headmistress has been giving Sharon her medicine, her HIV medicine. And then just last year, Sharon suddenly realized that this isn't aspirin she's been taking. She never knew she was HIV positive. Yeah. Nobody had ever told her. And she decided to stop taking her medicine. She decided she didn't want to live. And this was horrible. We ended up having to bring her home. We counseled her. We did everything we could. I went and I spoke to her when I was in Kenya the other day. I said, you know what, Sharon? You did not choose this. It's just happened. You just have to rise above this. I want you to go and stand up there because there are other children in this same situation. And you are going to be their ambassador. And she's now okay with it. But you see, how is she going to explain that to young men when she starts dating and says, guess what, I'm HIV positive? They're all going to say, yeah, right, we know how you got that. So, like I said, Sequoia is like peeling an onion. You start one thing and something else opens up. So now my thoughts are like, we really need to start looking at these children who were born this way through no fault of their own. And even though it is tiring work, it is depressing sometimes, because I am making a difference, it's okay. The sun rises and I feel good again.
Well, it sounds like what you're doing too is creating multiple futures, because if your only future for yourself, if the only future you can see is being a wife, then those prospects end once you understand you're HIV positive. But if there are other possibilities for you, an ambassador for other children and many, many other possibilities, then there's a way through this and more people can be helped. But that also suggests that the need for, again, more sort of locally created opportunities, businesses where people can own their own work, people can do meaningful work and not have to work for NGOs. I mean, the only meaningful work is something that doesn't pay very well locally, or you work for the local nonprofit, the international nonprofit or the UN. Is that any part of, and it doesn't have to be part of Sequoia's mission, you're a small group, but I wonder how you see that fitting in the big picture.
It is something that we have struggled with a lot, and actually we've come back full circle to the lake, and there is water hyacinth in Lake Victoria, which is a serious problem in Lake Victoria, but we've been trying to find solutions on how to deal with this water hyacinth. For example, making briquettes that can be used instead of cutting all the trees that we've cut, and this will provide jobs. And so the water hyacinth is a curse, but it's also a blessing.
Well, tell us about the curse. What's the problem with
it? It's a curse because what it does is it's killing the lake. Mm. It's very invasive. It was introduced there by accident, and it basically is killing. When I was a child, there was very many different kinds of fish. Now they're not as many as they used to be. But it's also a blessing because, for example, it removes some of the waste in the lake. So I've been working with a professor in New York who well, we have been working with a professor in New York who has some sort of water hyacinth through mediation. And we're hoping that there we'll be able to get a lot of our orphans and vulnerable children and people from the village employed there once that gets up and going.
You talked about adopting two children. Tell us about that. How did that come about?
I adopted the most wonderful children. One's name is Lovina, the other one is Lovinia, and they're not related. That really is just an accident. One was 11 and the other one was 14 when I adopted them. They were actually Sequoia children from way back when. So I have known them for a very long time. For example, Lovina's mother died at 8 in the morning and her father died at 8 at night the same day. And then somebody came. See, there are people who come to funerals to take away young girls. Because once you're dead, nobody knows who you knew or who you didn't know. So if somebody comes and says, oh, John is dead, John was my friend, and John said that I should take care of his children, you know, people are going to say, yes, please take them, because they've got too many that they're taking care of. Well, somebody came to take Lovina, and she just absolutely refused to go. She absolutely refused to go. So somebody at my mother's home from the village just brought her home and said, oh, yeah, here's this child, Sequoia. Look, there's this child. She's living with me. I don't know what to do with her. So she is one of those who I adopted. She's a feisty young lady. And then the other one, I knew her mother, and I think her mother may have known she was ill, I don't know. But I knew her mother, and so when I wanted to adopt again, went to the community and said, you know, it would be nice to have some kids with me in the U.S., so I adopted two of them. The truth is, I would have adopted more, but it would have been quite a lot of work. And I still do have many children in Kenya, okay? The other ones that I did not adopt are not any less my children.
But I do wonder about that because it's the same question of seeing the need and suddenly your eyes are open and you have this massive need and so many children in the same situation. So how do you, I mean, I understand there's limits to your time, but when you're looking at the situation, how do you walk away from that knowing you've done plenty? Nobody would hold you to it, but now that you've opened the door, how does that feel to walk away and say, oh, my goodness, I can't do this again? And these children have the needs are so great.
I'll go back to my mother. My mother is this strong dragon lady. And I once asked her that exact question. I said, how do you leave it? She says, you know, you have to set it aside and come back again tomorrow. You have to train others to take it over. You could die tomorrow. So what you have to do is to plant the seeds and set the groundwork and hope and believe that somebody will take it over. But you can't take it with you to bed at night because then in the morning you're useless and everybody gets hurt. So you just focus one at a time, one at a time.
And so many people have stepped up when you pointed out what was going on, that it must be encouraging to see that when you tell the story and when you show the need, others will step in to help and you don't have to do it all yourself.
Yeah, and this is one thing I've realized. You know the saying where they say it takes a village to raise a child? Well, I've realized that it actually takes a global village to raise an orphan or a vulnerable child. And I consider Sequoia my global village. Sequoia consists of people from all over. I mean, I have friends from Duke Hospital, the nurse's 7th floor. I have friends from NC State MBA School. These are all Sequoia tribal members. I have friends from Buffalo. Buffalo's been very big in Sequoia. I have friends, the Sequoia villages are from North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia. They're from New Jersey. They're from India. They're from Germany. They're from Canada. We have formed our own village, and we have our own needs, and we are meeting our needs.
This points, though, to the great paradox in terms of global aid and global meeting global needs. We have certainly professionalized, in many cases, our charitable and philanthropic efforts. It's come under great criticism. I know you're familiar with Dambisa Moyo's critique in Dead Aid, that the professionalization, the government-to-government aid, the large NGOs tend to be self-serving at this point, or often are. They pay too little attention to the social networks. There aren't enough people who, like you, are from the village. On the other hand, they get a lot done. They get a lot done, and they can attract the attention. They can attract the donations that get the work done. You know, how do we, or how do you see this happening, that we can keep a local connection, keep people connected in that social way that really affects change, and not commodify and professionalize the help, and still bring the resources that are needed?
The large NGOs are doing wonderful work, and they are necessary, and I applaud them. They really need to start setting aside some of their money to work with people in the diaspora. And notice I said people, not Africans. There are many of us who come to America. They need to find ways to facilitate our being able to help, because we are at the grassroots level. So if they can just set aside some money and say, okay, you're going to need a website, you're going to need to make a trip there, you're going to need to talk to the headmaster, talk to these people. This is the framework of what you need to do to create your own little Sequoia family so that you can go and help. They need to make it possible for us to do that. Now, the way we do Sequoia is we have what we call a friend raiser. And in the friend raiser, we basically cook African food. And we invite our friends and everybody. We invite all of our friends and we eat good food and we tell them what we've done. We do not ask for money. We tell them what we've done. We tell them our motto of 100% goes directly to those in need. And if you want to help, you do it yourself. And our friends give money. And it's happened. It's happened time and time and time again. It's happened since 2003. I would love to go to my other Kenyan friends, and I have, and said, look, if you need help, I can help you. But I don't have time to be writing a website for each and every one of them. I don't have time to be formalizing the accounting and telling them this is the template. Now, it would be great to have these agencies help me do that so I can say, go here, download this template, download this, do this, so they can all do it. And that would also alleviate the load from the larger NGOs.
That diaspora that you point to is another part of the paradox. So many of the programs that are created by large NGOs and small are education programs to help children get a good education, to get a profession. And then once they get it and they become doctors or professionals in other areas, they turn around and look home and say, well, we don't have the industry for me to work. Yes. The only place I can use this education now is elsewhere. So many want to stay home and can't if they want to use their education. So this is again, sort of part of the paradox, isn't it?
Yes, and so not only do they leave, once they leave, then they still don't even know how to go back and help. They'll end up sending money to their brother or to their sister, but not to the actual people who are in need, because they don't know how. You know, they think they're doing a good thing, and they are. But if they had other options, I'm very sure that they would take these other options. We can help ourselves. We really can.
We are talking today to a software engineer and a humanitarian who is the founder of Sequoia Helping Hands, and that's a conversation going on today on The State of Things. Junie Aseo is my guest, and is what you're doing at Sequoia Helping Hands replicable? Can it be scaled up and replicated if I just put the documents online, or is it so unique to what you've done that sort of everybody is going to have to create their own nonprofit?
I think it's completely replicatable. I think anybody can do this because it's so straightforward, and we've made all of the mistakes. Now you can just learn from our mistakes. And it really wasn't hard looking back. It was hard, but it really wasn't hard. Everybody who is here, we all want to help. I think it's an innate human desire. We want to help. Many times we don't know. I mean, you'll go to a hospital, you'll see a sick person, you want to help, you don't know how. You know, you're driving, there's an accident, you want to help, you don't know how. You see a child struggling with something, you want to help, you don't know how. We're saying, if you want to help here, which we know you do, this is how. And yes, you can replicate it. And don't only repeat it for yourself, we want you also to now get your friends to do the same thing.
What are your plans for the future for the organization?
You know, I go one day at a time. You know, I don't plan. I just do.
You did say that earlier.
It has been, I wish I planned more. But, you know, like I said, there was Sharon with this. Suddenly, what am I going to do with the 13-year-old who's HIV positive? And I know when I go back again, I'll find somebody else. And then I just go wherever. I guess I'm kind of like a lake, like a river. And this comes from my being a lure following the river. Where the river goes, I will follow. I don't plan.
How about people in the organization? I mean, again, that's always or can be a struggle in an organization that is met with some success on a small scale, the pressure to scale up, to make it bigger, to become something larger and of course, therefore do more good. But with it comes all of the dangers of scaling up.
We've thought of scaling up, but remember, we also contribute a lot of money to this. You know, in Sequoia, if you decide you want to get involved, you're doing a lot of the work. So at some point you're like, okay, I think we better keep this just so. And by scaling up, it means you're going to have to do more. We don't have fancy offices. We don't have administrative assistants. I'm the accountant. We don't have any of those things. You're volunteering. So it would be nice to scale up. I don't think it's going to happen.
All right. Well, wonderful work and a real pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to be here.
Talking today to Junie Aseo. Junie is a software engineer and a humanitarian. She runs the nonprofit Sequoia Helping Hands. It provides AIDS awareness and work to improve living conditions in villages in Kenya. You can, of course, find out more information at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Howdy Mwagdi, and Will Michaels. Our technical director is Robin Copley. Our intern is Jess Clark. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.